Hello and welcome to the Blockade Runner podcast number 232. My name is John. Joining me today is Ryan. What's up, Ryan?
Hey, good morning. I am here in chilly, sunny Denver, Colorado. It is extremely sunny. I've had to readjust the windows and blinds in here like five times since we started getting set up because the sun is just raging and it's cold.
Okay. Okay. Now here in Rockford, it's cloudy. The autumn is showing all of its colors. The leaves are changing. It's beautiful, but cloudy outside. It's actually perfect weather for All Hallows Eve Eve because we're recording here on the day before Halloween. Mm-hmm. And we're looking at temperatures about 60 degrees Fahrenheit today, Ryan. So that's actually not too bad here in Rockford. So, yeah. I guess it's just that crisp mountain air that's chilling things down for you in Denver. But I don't know. But also, this has been a crazy busy week in the world of Star Wars. So we got to get into it. We are going to attempt today to tackle Andor episode 8, which is called Narkeena 5. We're going to try to tackle that. We are going to read a really insightful message from our friend Dave in Japan. So that's going to be part of our Andor discussion. Lucasfilm and Dave Filoni went and dropped 6 episodes of Tales of the Jedi on us on Wednesday as well. So we're going to discuss that. And then The Hollywood Reporter was like, hey, guess what? In case this week isn't busy enough, let's talk about a new Star Wars movie in development. So yeah, there's a lot to discuss today. So we're going to do our best to tackle all of that. Let's start by discussing Andor episode 8, Narkeena 5. This is the first time, Ryan, that I'm talking about an episode of Andor on the show that I haven't watched it twice. So,
oh, really?
Okay. Yeah. I just didn't have time this week. So my memory is a little more hazy than usual, but as is always 100% every single time the case with Andor, it was an excellent episode.
And we didn't record last week for episode 7.
Wait, what? Really?
Yeah, we did not record announcement either. And you know, this episode is kind of building directly off of what happened in that episode. So we're kind of going to be talking a little bit about both of them simultaneously.
Okay, this is wild because here I am. Ryan, you're looking at the notes. I mean, they're relatively detailed. You know, I thought I was coming into this prepared, and now I'm finding out there's a whole ass episode of Andor that we haven't covered that I'm meant to be talking about today.
Yeah.
Oh, no.
Well, I mean, you're half prepared. You got 1 out of 2 episodes that we haven't talked about. So I think that's a good place. Okay. Episode 7, I thought, was just a really interesting episode because it was, you know, dealing with the fallout of what happened in like the, I guess we could call it the second trilogy of Andor episodes. Following the heist, like there is, and this is, you know, something I love deeply about this show is, you know, it really goes into the consequences of one's actions and the repercussions of everything. And it like really, you know, kind of, focuses on those things in a fascinating way, which we don't always see in Star Wars because, you know, I think there's like, you know, famous examples from the films of like, you know, Alderaan, you know, being destroyed and then, you know, people being sad for like 2 minutes and then like just kind of like moving on with the adventure. And, you know, I guess like something like Hosnian Prime in Force Awakens, and you're like, whoa, that was like this huge like thing with like these galaxy wide repercussions. And then it's like, well, on, you know, on to the next. And, you know, that's, you know, necessary to that storytelling, like what those movies were going for. Like they weren't, you know, trying to, you know, dwell on these things, and, you know, they were just plot points. But then, like, I think what's cool and what makes Andor feel so fresh in Star Wars is like, yeah, like actions have consequences that like they're far reaching and deep reaching consequences. And I think, you know, episode 7 was continuing to explore that. And, you know, we get, there's been that meme that started going around about how like the new hotness in Star Wars is ISB meetings, which I love, because like, I mean, honestly, you get when we cut in, we're in that like ISB room, I'm like, oh yeah, this is the good stuff right here. Like this is the new lightsaber battle for me. Yeah, I love those meetings. And so you get to see like, you know, after the heist, which was, you know, somewhat effective, somewhat disastrous. It was a complicated heist with a lot of complicated fallout. And you get to see how is the group of rebels, you know, what were the repercussions for them? Like, where are they all at? And then, you know, what was the repercussions for the Empire? And so we start to explore that in episode 7, and that continues into 8.
Yeah. As you were discussing that, I was remembering one of my favorite moments, I believe, from episode 7, which is Mon Mothma showing up to visit Luthen at his art gallery again. And she's like, people are going to suffer. And he's like, that's the plan, you know? And just that conflict between those two sides of this rebellion, Luthen is like pretty antsy, I think, to kind of really kick things into high gear and sort of come out of the shadows and really put together this rebellion, which continues in episode 8, because he goes to see Saw Gerrera and is sort of mm-hmm. pushing Saw to help him with some mission or project or whatever. But it would require Saw working with another sort of rebel faction or group. And it really seems like he's trying to, you know, put this network together, create this network, bring everybody together and like be like, okay, the rebellion is here. Hence the title of episode 7 announcement, you know, like it's time to like really have our coming out party and stop like, you know, sneaking around in the shadows and really be like, let's do this. But he needs everyone to come together, you know, in order for that to happen. I mean, there's another moment in the 8th episode where, and I forget her name at the moment, but his partner at the gallery is pushing him to like cut off communications with Ferrix and with Bix, you know, it's too dangerous or whatever. And he doesn't want to do it. Eventually he does. But, you know, yeah, it's just like, he is really trying to, I think, maybe recklessly, but he's really trying to build those connections and actually not only build them, but like really, you know, turn this into the moment where instead of this being a group of disconnected cells, they kind of come mm-hmm. together as one powerful sort of unit.
Yeah. And so like a common theme, I think we can talk about like in regards to like both episodes is what you were just saying, how he wants to, you know, unify the rebellion, but at the same time, like the different factions are so interesting because you have like Mon Mothma, who's like to Luthen, who's like, okay, you're a little too extreme. You're, you know, a little bit too far from center for like what we're trying to do here. Like, and then you have like Saw Gerrera, who I don't know if it's as explicit here, but like we also know Saw Gerrera from Rogue One. And then like I think Saw is in probably some ways be like, no, you're not extreme enough. Like, right. If you were like a real gorilla, you would be down here in the trenches with us and not, you know, playing around on Coruscant kind of thing. So that's
yeah.
Like,
although it's interesting because Luthen tells Saw, like, you know, you're just going to sit down here in this cave, like whoop-de-doo.
Yeah.
Like, what are you really doing in this cave right now? I need you to like actually get out and like be engaged in a mission with this other, you know, faction or whatever. So
yeah, that's a good point. So I wonder if like if Luthen is like, if part of this story is like, this is how Saw gets further radicalized. Maybe Luthen is the furthest from center in all this.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I do think there's a possibility of that, you know, because everybody kind of keeps telling Luthen, like, hey, maybe this is too much, maybe this is too fast, whatever. Mm-hmm. I'm not entirely sure kind of what direction it's going to go, you know, if it's going to turn out that, like, he is making a mistake here. You know, I think his perspective is like, yes, it's going to be messy. Yes, there mm-hmm. are going to be casualties. Yes, this is unsafe, you know, whatever. But we can't just sit around anymore. And I'm sure that is valid in a lot of ways, but also, like, mm-hmm. you know, recommendations or advice to maybe chill out a little bit or hold on or, you know, be a little more, kind of careful in how to proceed are probably valid as well. So, yeah, I don't know kind of like what the takeaway is going to be at the end of the season or the end of this story, as far as like, was Luthen going too hard or like, was he mm-hmm. the necessary agent to kind of push everybody to come together and actually like step up, and not that they haven't been stepping up, you know, in various ways, but like really kind of coordinate and make this announcement, you know, to the Empire.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I love that. I was just going to say, I love that Miro is like seeing that, and Cyril Karn to a certain extent too, but really Miro is like, hello, ISB, like this is an announcement. Like, can you not see that all these different pieces have been doing this and we need to figure out like, mm-hmm. what is the connection and how is this being coordinated and what are they going to do, you know, sort of next? While a lot of the rest of the ISB and the Empire is kind of seemingly pretty willing to just be like, oh, well, that was an annoyance or, you know, whatever. You know, we're seeing at one time Luthen and Mothma and Saw and Bix and, you know, all these different various rebel, you know, kind of entities sort of working and on their own, but also kind of coming together to a certain extent. And then, you know, meanwhile, we're also watching like, Miro and the ISB sort of starting to figure that out. And, you know, we have that kind of duality there or whatever you want to say, like where mm-hmm. we're seeing both sides kind of, you know, in this, this conflict or this sort of like, this race to either, you know, squash the rebellion or kind of push the rebellion forward.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, Luthen is just like, has become an even more interesting character. Like, he was always a compelling character with, like, you know, a great performance by Stellan Skarsgård. But I think in these episodes, there's just continued layers of complexity with him. And I think what the show's doing really well with him as currently kind of the figurehead, the head of, you know, at least from the viewer's perspective, the head trying to unify the rebellion here. I think something that's captured really well is just the imperfections of revolutionaries. And I think, you know, you look through human history and at different agents of change for, you know, governments, societies, those people are always flawed and like they're doing something for the first time and they're doing something impossible and there's going to be mistakes and there's going to be these like character flaws and there's going to be, you know, this sometimes like a lack of empathy with just like such a focus on the cause. And, you know, we see that with him. We see Mon Mothma trying to straddle that line as well in her position. You know, she's in her situation's like totally different because she has a family and, you know, a very like public career as a senator that she's also trying to balance. But like the show is not afraid to point out her like some of her flaws and missteps along the way. And then I think it all kind of, for Luthen though, it kind of comes down to like is his like core thesis correct? Is it true that if groups unite and continue to be like a thorn in the side of the empire and like really hit them in different areas where it hurts, is it true that the empire is going to crack down further, and that's going to lead to more people rebelling? Which I think is just like a really fascinating like sociological conundrum here. Like what happens, like, as you know, as fascism spreads, if it gets like more fascist, do people start like standing up more, or do people just fall in line more and just give up their freedoms and their rights willingly just to not rock the boat? And I think that's like a really interesting ethical question kind of at the center of his character right now.
Yeah, for sure. And it also struck me, I mean, I think this is sort of coincidence, and also sort of just, these are some of the ideas that Star Wars explores because of the sort of civil war conflict aspect of like the larger story. But, mm-hmm. you know, and we'll talk about Tales of the Jedi in a little bit, but, you know, watching that Dooku episode, the last Dooku episode, as he's talking to Yaddle and discussing sort of like, you know, he's, as always, like right before his turn to the dark side, you know, as most characters we see, like when they're making that turn, they're a little bit, you know, or they're quite a bit conflicted. So he's sort mm-hmm. of like, mm-hmm. I've done awful things. I've betrayed everyone. You know, I've done all this awful stuff. But like, obviously he also sort of decides like, well, and I think he says something to Yaddle to that effect, but you know, it's what has to happen. Like, well, we're going to bring peace and order, and you know, that process is going to be, we have to do some things that aren't great. You know what I mean? Or people have to suffer, or we have to compromise ourselves. I mean, that's something that is part of Saw Gerrera's journey as well, you know? So, mm-hmm. Yeah, just kind of seeing that with Luthen, like, yeah, I want like people to suffer so that it can bring about the change that needs to come about. And, you know, obviously with Dooku and Anakin and Kylo Ren and all these other characters that, you know, kind of fall to the dark side, it's one of those things where we as an audience watch and say, you know, you're justifying it to yourself and you think you have good intentions, but we can clearly see like how, you know, these choices you're making are wrong and how, mm-hmm. It's obviously evil and the dark side and all that. But you know, in a show like this, it's so compelling to see somebody like Luthen who, isn't, you know, we're not one or two episodes away from him being like at the foot of the empire. Yeah. Assassinating people. And just like, you know, cause we have those moments in the space opera Star Wars stories where like a character mm-hmm. just makes those big, epic, like obviously evil choices. And, mm-hmm. and we go, well, okay, well they jumped ship. They're on the dark side now, you know? And then later on, they usually like jump back or whatever. And that's fine too. But you know, I don't think it's going to be that kind of story, but at the same time, it's just interesting to look at this and sort of think like, like where is Luthen making good choices and where are his choices maybe potentially, you know, the wrong ones. And that's true of so many characters in Andor, right? I obviously can say that about Cassian at multiple mm-hmm. points and Ix and, you know, in the first episodes or second episode or whatever, like just almost all these characters, there's a real complexity to the situations they find themselves in, the choices they have to make, and the morality behind those decisions.
Yeah. And, kind of last thing I wanted to say on this is, kind of building on what you were saying, like we have had like morality in Star Wars has been traditionally like light side, dark side, Jedi, Sith kind of thing. And I think like now I feel like I can almost pinpoint the moment of like the genesis for the Andor story that we're enjoying now is in Rogue One, that the part where Andor says like, I've done horrible things. Like that is not something I feel like that like moment is what the Andor show is, like what that's exploring is like that line of dialogue. Cause like we've had, you know, we've had scoundrels, we've had, you know, Han Solo, Lando, like who, you know, maybe like kind of like walked a line, and, you know, did, you know, especially in Lando's case, like, you know, maybe did some bad things at like different points. But like, yeah, to like the extent of it. Yeah, I feel like the genesis of like what we're exploring does kind of come from that line in Rogue One. And that's really fascinating because it's just a whole new era of, you know, Star Wars storytelling. It's just a totally new type. And even like Mandalorian, like, yeah, like he's a bounty hunter. But like, you know, by 3 episodes into, you know, season 1 of Mandalorian, where like, you know, he went from like this kind of like gray area bounty hunter guy to like, oh, this is a dude with a heart of gold kind of thing. And, and yeah, and I think this is further complicating the structures of morality within Star Wars, and it's a fascinating thing to be experiencing.
Yeah, for sure. Let's talk about especially with Episode 7 in the mix, you know, but between both of these episodes. One of the most interesting things is the relationship with Cassian and Marva, and Cassian coming back to Ferrix to say like, hey, I have some money. Let's go, you know, come on, mom. Like, I'm going to get you out of here. You know, no more worrying about trying to pay the heat bill and suffering through this life on Ferrix. The scene where, cause it's two scenes, I think in Episode 7 that, you know, feature them together. The scene where he comes back the next day after visiting Bix and she tells him she's not going is like such an emotional and such an incredible scene. I feel like the performance from Fiona Shaw as Marva there is, you know, so incredible. And there's some great lines of dialogue in that scene as well. So that was maybe the highlight of these two episodes for me, is that just sort of very personal, you know, moment or personal scenes between Cassian and Marva. And then in Episode 8 to see her kind of slipping, you know, literally falls. I mean, off screen, but, you know, we know that she falls and hurts herself. And, you know, the community is sort of Bix and I forget the guy with the gloves, but that guy's cool, Brasser or something like that. I forget his name.
Yeah.
You know, they're talking about like, look, we together as a community are trying to take care of this lady, but like she really is not even necessarily able to take care of herself anymore, you know?
Yeah, she's a rebel.
Well, she is a rebel, man. Yeah, and they talk about it like, oh, she's delusional or something. She thinks she's here fighting the Empire. I think that's going to end up being, I think she's going to be validated in that before long. But
I think she already is. Like, I think, you know, her character is just wonderful, where she's just like old and, you know, has these like health challenges, but she's still like, I don't care. Like,
yeah,
this stuff that's happening is wrong, and whatever I can do to like hurt these people, I will do.
Like, yeah, but that's the thing, because Cassian and Bix and everybody are sort of saying to themselves and to her, you're not doing anything. You know what I mean? Like, you're not doing anything to hurt them.
Yeah.
Like, you're here, but you're not actually making any kind of difference. And I think something's going to happen to prove them wrong, you know, not just to us as the audience, but also to them. I think she's going to be, you know, I don't know what it'll be, but I think in some way she will kind of twist the screws on the Empire or hurt the Empire or something. But I'm also just not feeling good about her chances long term here, in terms of surviving and continuing to be a part of the show after watching Episode 8. So I'm a little nervous about that.
Yeah. Yep.
Okay. Just shout out to the line of dialogue. Cassian's like, I will be worried about you all the time. If you stay here and I go, I'll be worried about you all the time. And I think right before that, she basically tells him, like, you can't stay and I can't leave. And that's like, that moment was heartbreaking, but I'll be worried about you all the time. And she says, that's just love. There's nothing that can be done about
that.
Man,
that there is your like quintessential Star Wars dialogue right there. Just distilling so much of like human existence into like one line.
Yeah. Yeah. There are and there are a few, of course, like throughout Star Wars, I have one tattooed on my arm actually. And, you know, there are a few lines that are just these aphorisms, you know, these like nuggets of wisdom and knowledge, mm-hmm. and just like beautifully distilled lines of dialogue like that. But, you know, as you said, it's your quintessential Star Wars. It's like, also to me, it's like, well, I don't know though, because like I feel like I've rarely seen Star Wars kind of be that personal, and usually it's this grand kind of epic sort of thing. Mm. You know what I mean? Do or do not, there is no try. Although, you know, that one's a little cliche and played out at this point, but you know what I'm saying? Like those sorts of lines, right? They're these bigger sort of, you know, epic scope kind of lines. And so to have something so kind of personal and, you know, like that is applicable to anyone's life. You know what I mean? And so are a lot of things, but yeah. In Star Wars, but I mean, like this one just feels different. It just feels like, you know, man, a moment of wisdom that is not in any way sort of heightened or you know, part of some, I don't know, giant scale type thing, but just a really human emotional kind of moment that, I mean, I could see that in some, that line being delivered in some indie drama or something, you know, mm-hmm. which
something
I wouldn't
else
really say.
Adam Driver.
right. So, that one just it hit different, Ryan. That one hit mm-hmm. different for me.
Yeah.
So, and it's absolutely a highlight of the show and the season and all that for me.
Yeah.
Okay. We probably should, before we get into the message from Dave, talk about like one of the major story arc moments, of these two episodes, like what's mm-hmm. sort of driving Cassian's story here, which is the fact that he gets arrested and thrown in THX-1138 jail. So that was crazy. Uh-huh. Everybody's losing their mind for the music, in that scene when he's like, you know, walking down the boardwalk in that like beach town or whatever.
Oh my God, so good.
I didn't like that music actually very much. I mean, I don't want to say I hated it or anything, but I was like, that was one moment where I was watching the show where I was like, ooh, this music, I'm not, it's a little bit like, it's very different, intentionally so. But it's probably like maybe my least favorite music from the season so far.
Oh, wow.
But no, it got the opposite reaction from. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
I got the opposite reaction.
Yeah. I love the like in the integration of like electronic elements, which we were already like, I think, you know, people initially there was some like pushback on electronic elements in like Mandalorian's score and stuff, but I think, you know, you just gotta try something and then you realize, okay, this isn't the worst thing in the world, it's a little different, but it can also be cool. So I think we were a little more prepared for you know, electronic aspects in the music for the show, but I think like what's interesting is the way that, especially in that scene, like there, it's incorporating like pop elements in a way, like pop production kind of thing, in there. And like, we were, you know, into like almost full like Daft Punk territory there. And I think it's great. Like it's different. It's interesting. I think, yeah, it sets the mood for like what that scene was. And I thought it sounded really good. I just enjoyed it.
Yeah. Yeah, I certainly wouldn't try to suggest it was like, you know, a poor choice or badly done or anything like that. Just like, I was just surprised at how much people loved it. Cause as I was watching it, I was like, oh, this feels a little weird to me. But also, as you pointed out, like that's the intention too. Part of it is that it's like such a different vibe in that scene. Like everything about that scene is completely like a different vibe from until it turns, right? And he's like,
yeah,
oh, whoops, you're going to jail for nothing. And so, yeah, I mean, it certainly demonstrates the callousness and sort of abuse of the Empire, you know, to he basically is just in the wrong place at the wrong time and gets, what, 6 years, I think? Six years in jail, something like that. And then, of course, in episode 8, we go to this prison. Narkeena 5 is the name of the episode, and I believe the planet that they're on where this prison is, or unless it's the name of the prison itself. wow, I don't know how he's going to get out of there, because you can't even step on the floor without dying if they want you to die. And also the planet's like in the middle of an ocean, which is like sucking in water. And, you know, it would be very difficult to even swim from one prison to the next, let alone to safety. So he's in a pretty rough place there. Obviously, you know, they are sort of wearing down the spirits of these prisoners. We even see that with Cassian, because the episode does jump a sort of, I think, like 30 days or something in his time in that prison.
And or something.
Yeah, 30 shifts. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. Which are like 12-hour shifts. And insane. But anyway, you know, by the end there, he's like really just going through the motions along with everybody else, right? I mean, that's the only way to survive there, it seems like. So,
I mean, also in episode 8, does he have a single line of dialogue?
He must, but that's an interesting point. I'm sure he does, but I don't know.
He barely, well, if there's any dialogue, there's barely any from him, because he is just, it is all just facial expressions. You just see his, like, his shock, his horror, his just becoming disheartened by the whole thing. So a few things. It's also, like you mentioned, it is straight THX1138 in there. That's just a very very obvious homage there, with both the look of it and like what's happening in there, which
I just want to say very quickly, like, that's another example of like, oh, did you hear that we're getting a Star Wars show from a guy who doesn't like Star Wars and has no reverence for that stuff? And he's like, oh, Star Wars, whatever. Like, I don't think so. That's not really, he may have started in that place, but I think it's pretty clear that's not the place he's in now, you know? So,
Yeah.
And, which is fine. But anyway, like, I'm sorry. Continue. Yeah.
I think like this, this whole setup, I know it was a little controversial in our friend group. I haven't seen much controversy online, but our friend Chris was a little bit not sold on this whole setup. He was saying like, it just feels like this is just like setting up for like a prison break. Like, what's the point kind of thing? So I think like in some ways that's valid, because it's kind of the, like what we've talked about before, like, oh, this is the Star Wars thing where they infiltrate an Empire facility. And like, oh, this is the Star Wars thing when someone is, you know, a rebel is liberated from an Empire facility. I think he's probably right. That is just what's going to happen. Like, eventually people are going to come and break Cassian out. But I think there's a few things about that. I think one, there's the possibility that that's not what happens, and there's like a time jump where it is like he serves out his full 6-year sentence there.
That would take us past the events of the original trilogy. Well, at least of A New Hope, I think. Rogue One,
really?
New Hope, if it was that long. Yeah.
So, yeah. Okay. So, I think so. Yeah, it's, Okay, that's what I was going to say. I don't know timeline stuff. I haven't done the math on it. I believe,
just to drop some straight facts here, I believe, and when I say straight facts, I'm not 100% sure I remember this correctly, but okay, I believe the first season is this 1 year of Cassian's life or whatever. Okay. And then the next season coming up is 4 years. So it covers like the 4 years leading up to Rogue One. So the second season is going to end butting like right up to Rogue One. But right now I think we're roughly like 5 years before Rogue One. And then,
okay,
this season's just 1 year. And then next season is 4 years somehow. And you said there's like a really clever way that they're doing that, or I don't know what, but anyway, that's season two.
So no doubts there. And then the other thing I was going to say, like the other reason that doesn't seem likely is I don't think the Empire is going to be letting people out of this prison when their sentences are up. So I don't actually think that's a possibility. I think they are there. They are free labor, which is, also commentary on a lot of prison systems in the world, including right here at home in the United States. Prisoners who are incarcerated for minor offenses to be cheap labor and be held indefinitely. So all that aside, I think what it will likely come down to is like a prison break. Which is fine. It's a thing that happens in Star Wars. It's a thing that happens in the television show Prison Break, if you are familiar with that.
As advertised, yeah. As advertised, yep.
Yeah, and in many other mediums, it's fine. It's a thing that happens. It's a storytelling thing. But what I wanted to, like, in defense of this setup, is I think it does a few things. For one, it gives a chance to like see cool THX-1138 stuff happening, which is fun. Then also, I think it tells a story of, like you were saying, of how the Empire is at this point, where they are just incarcerating people for minor offenses or for nothing, and just breaking their spirits in prison. It's the whole teach them a lesson, so either they're off the streets, or when they get back to the streets, they'll never rebel in any capacity again. Just breaking people in that way, making them fearful of authority. But I think the biggest part of this for the story that's being told here about Andor is, like, this is probably for him, I think, when he is out, whether he's he will be like broken out because there's no other real way. I don't think it will make him more fearful of the Empire. I think it's going to further radicalize him and make him hate the Empire more. And so this is something I'm like kind of worried about, because like we know one of like the core plot points of the show is like, how does Andor go from like kind of like a mercenary to someone who's like part of this cause, and because like and being as hardcore as he is, when we get to Rogue One, like, what is that journey for him? Like, I think this is something I'm very cool with being part of his, like, journey and becoming radicalized against the Empire. Something I don't really want to happen, which you kind of alluded to earlier, and I'm fearful of it happening, is the death of his mom. Like, if something happens to her caused by the Empire, and like that being a motivation for him, which it would be, but I think that also like kind of gets to like, you know, like women in refrigerators, like kind of revenge type storytelling, which I'm a little nervous about happening. We'll see where things are going and how they're handled. But I think this is like a good way to kind of like move the needle for him in his like belief structure.
Yeah. I mean, I think like end of episode 7, he's just on a beach, like, you know, like back to his old ways, right? Like he's got a little bit of money. Mm-hmm. He's, you know, has his fling of the week or the month or whatever that's, yeah, you know, in the other room while he's taking his shower and he just is, you know, kind of treading water, right? And so like, how do you get from, okay, well, that's where he is, to, you know, him being more invested again? And yeah, I think like, you know, the Empire taking his freedom, that's going to be a big part of it. If it is Luthen or, you know, some component of this rebellion that breaks him out, then I think, you know, obviously that may make him that much more likely to be involved. You know, I think Marva, I mean, part of it is that she is an older character, but just the way in this episode, episode 8, you know, they were talking about her health and all that stuff. I think in one way or another, I just don't see her kind of, you know, remaining for the long haul. Mm-hmm. But I think that's going to be true of like a lot of characters in this show, you know, in general. So I know Tony Gilroy said at one point the body count is high for sure. And yeah, that's definitely was the case with Rogue One, right? Like, basically everyone got fridged in that movie. So, you know, I mean, I would not like in that way, like that yeah, it's a bad thing, but like, you know, if we're concerned of if they're going to be willing to kill people off or not, or whatever, I think a lot of these people are going to go. It'll be interesting to see what happens with Bix. There's also Val and there's mm-hmm. Cinta, and, you know, I mean, there's so many characters. So, you know, if I don't know, I think deaths are going to be used to motivate characters for sure. I don't know who's and when and how well it'll be done, yeah, or won't be done, but I think that's definitely something we need to be ready for with this show. But also there's all these prisoners that he's like, okay, he's lost his freedom. All these other prisoners have lost their freedom too, right? We already saw one of them commit suicide towards the end of this mm-hmm. episode, you know, throwing himself down onto that floor. And so I think that can be part of this journey too, for him to become more invested in the rebellion. Like, what's going to happen with all these prisoners here? If he is broken out, like, do all of them stay there? Like, are they all going to be there? Or is it going to be a thing where like he gets out and then, you know, part of his getting invested in the rebellion is to be like, okay, well, all these people are still here on this planet being dehumanized by the Empire. And like, that's something I've been in there. You know what I mean? I know how it works. Like, he could potentially lead a prison break of his own, you know, after being broken out, you know, himself, because I would imagine they're going to, or who knows, maybe this is another form of announcement, you know, like this would be something that would really hurt the Empire too, if the rebellion was able to come in there and not only break Cassian out, but like really, you know, get a lot of people out or destroy that prison in some way or whatever. So, you know, I don't know. I will say that this might be the episode I enjoyed watching the least of all of the episodes of the show so far, but that's really doesn't say anything because like every episode has been so good. But like this one, I don't know. I guess maybe it's so oppressive, like the prison setting and all uh-huh. that stuff. It's just like, you know, I don't know.
It's not fun.
Yeah. So anyway, but I'm certainly, you know, very interested in this story, and I like the direction, you know, that it's going, even if, you know, seeing all these people in this like creepy hospital like prison isn't, you know, super joyful to watch necessarily.
Yeah. I think this would, be on towards the top of my list, for episodes. I think it's not quite at the top, but I really enjoyed this episode. I think there's one thing that didn't totally sit right with me, which is just kind of like a personal thing. But I think having Andy Serkis in there, like he was great in the episode, but it was also one of those things where I was like, that's Andy Serkis. Like,
yeah,
just like, you know, he's just a very recognizable actor. And I'm like, yep, he's, you know, he's being a gruff Andy Serkis right now. I think that just kind of took me out a little bit. I think that's the danger of like using, you know, super recognizable actors and stuff. Aside from that, like, I think the visual style is just like so different. And I think like this episode continued to like go deeper and deeper and like muddy up the waters around like the show's themes and everything, like we were talking earlier about like the different approaches to rebellion and stuff. And then there's also just honestly probably my favorite moment in the episode, and one when we're like talking about, you know, those deeply personal relationships and love and everything, is the moment between Vel and Cinta, where they're talking and they're like basically having to like figure out their future. You know, we get to see just how complicated and challenging their relationship is because of their positions and, you know, being part of this. And there's just another just amazing line in there that the struggle will always come first. We get what's left. And like that, I think, is just it's like heartbreaking and powerful and really, you know, you talk about stakes, and you know, we have Star Wars where the stakes are the fate of the galaxy, and then you have Star Wars where the stakes are, well, I mean, the fate of the galaxy and like what these people are doing, but also there's like these intimate interpersonal stakes as well, like how their existence in this rebellion is just, you know, straining their relationship and their chance to like find love and to be happy. I thought that was just like really powerful and excellent as well.
Yeah, and I love it. Like these episodes, and the show in general, but especially like these last couple episodes, are really asking the question of like, how far are you willing to go, and mm-hmm. how far should you go, you know, in the name of rebellion, or standing up to oppression or whatever. And you know, we're seeing that like Val definitely doesn't have the same perspective of Luthen or even of Cinta, you know, because Cinta seems very much to be like, okay, well, like this is what we have to do, and like as you said, the mission always comes first, right? Actually, something really interesting that I wanted to go back and look, but I didn't do this, but I was listening to Steele Saunders and Haas Burkhart, two names listeners are probably familiar with from the Star Wars podcasting community. I was listening to a conversation they were having about the end of the Aldani arc and Cinta, and apparently like when, so after the ship gets out of there, and you know, we know that they kind of escape or whatever, there's a shot or a couple shots that kind of are back on Aldani, one of Cinta sort of like going down to where the celebration is happening, or not the celebration, but like the, you know, everybody watching the eye taking place and all that. Anyway, long story short, they were saying that she is crying as she's walking out of that that structure, and that she's wearing an Imperial uniform. But like, they were wearing Imperial uniforms the whole time. But anyway, their argument or their conclusion was that she killed the woman, the wife and the child. And that's why she was crying as she was walking out of there. I don't know if you caught that or thought that was the case or not. And like I said, I haven't been able to go back and watch it, to see that, but I've watched it twice, you know, before I heard them talk about that. And I didn't really notice that she seemed to be distraught or crying or anything, but if that's the case, that makes so much sense. Considering what has followed in terms of like Cinta being like, got to do what we got to do. And even Val tells, you know, the commandant or whatever his name is, like, well, we're not going to kill you just because that's what you would do to us, you know? And if like in this conversation with Cinta and Val later on, it's, you know, they clearly have different perspectives, right? Like Cinta's like, no, always the mission first. And Val, you know, doesn't seem to feel that way. And also Val is being tasked with assassinating Cassian Andor, who I think she believes is a decent guy at this point, right? Like, you know, she gave Cassian Nemec's manifesto. And, anyway, so like this is, I think, a potentially extremely compelling conflict brewing here. You know, how far has Cinta gone? We know we know Cassian has gone to those lengths, right? He's killed people in cold blood because it was like something he had to do. And if you think about it, the show doesn't, I don't know, like the first thing that happens in the show is Cassian murders someone. Because it would be too dangerous for them to stick around having seen his face, you know? And then it's like, okay, well, Cinta, if she's the one who's left with that mother and son, does it actually make sense from the perspective of someone who says the mission always comes first, from the perspective of an organization that is asking Vale to find and murder Cassian? Does it make sense from those people's perspective that she would be like, yeah, well, we'll just let this woman and child, you know, live after having spent all this time with us looking at our faces, et cetera. So I really wonder if that's, I don't really wonder. I think I feel pretty strongly that that's where this is going, with Cinta being extremely hardcore and willing to do anything that needs to be done, and Vale not quite being there.
Yeah. That is something else to chew on.
So shout out to those guys for catching that, because I wouldn't have caught it or didn't catch it. But after I heard them talk about it, I think they talked about it before this episode came out, with this conversation with Val and Cinta, but like it really shed some light on that whole situation. So super interesting.
Yeah.
Ryan, should we move on to the letter from Dave here, the message from Dave?
Yeah. Speaking of good takes and shout outs, thank you, Dave Halvison, for writing this in.
Yeah, for sure. Just kind of go through a few paragraphs and talk about Dave's ideas, I guess.
Yeah. Do you want me to read it?
Sure.
Okay. All right. So Dave wrote to us and said, with each passing week, Andor continues to send my historian mind into deep exploration on the ugly legacy of colonialism that we in the West are the benefactors of, and Japan to a certain extent, but that's a long and complicated story in its own right. Dave is initially from the US and he currently lives in Japan, just to clarify that. The Aldani set of episodes was not only a brilliantly written three-part thriller of an arc, but a multi-layered exploration of how colonialism in its most malignant form works. The visual imagery of the episodes instantly brought to mind the Scottish Highlands, and indeed it seems some filming was done in Scotland. For anyone familiar with the history of the British Isles, there are many parallels there to be examined. The Gaelic-speaking peoples that originally inhabited Ireland and the British Isles first encountered a colonizing presence in the Roman Empire. The remnants of Hadrian's Wall in North England are a testament to how the Romans gave up trying to colonize the Gaelic peoples and instead work to keep them out. Next were the Angles and Saxons from present-day Germany, which brought an end to the Roman Empire's rule in Britain, then the Norse, and finally the Normans, which were transplanted Norse in France that became Francophied. All the while, there was this continuous dynamic between the Scots and Welsh in their highlands and the ruling power that came to govern England and later Ireland in the 1600s. As we see in Andor, the Empire tried to bring these people down from the highlands and give them access to goods and other trinkets they could not make for themselves. The Eldani, Denzians, did not necessarily need these items, as it is clear they had a vibrant culture and were self-sufficient. However, in getting them to become dependent on these goods, the Eldani that did move down lost their self-sufficiency and found themselves slaves to the sustenance the Empire provided. Stripped of their self-sufficiency and their language, I believe we can assume the Empire found it easier to control them and ultimately subjugate them. Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, well, just that, you know, this kind of historical perspective, as Dave describes it or argues that it's part of the makeup of this conflict, you know, this hypothetical, this fictional conflict in Andor. Yeah, especially as he describes, you know, how the Scots and the Welsh were brought down from their highlands by the British Empire, and we're seeing the Eldani brought down from the highlands by this empire, and, you know, they actually filmed it there in that place. Hard to believe that is not an intentional and extremely relevant and interesting, you know, kind of choice by the writers of the show. So, yeah, sorry, I guess Star Wars is political, because that is, you know, I think Dave makes a really strong case that, look, this is what is happening here. This is not just a, I shouldn't even just say just, but this fictional conflict is very much based in actual historical imperialism. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I think like the exploration and condemnation of imperialism in the show would be pretty, I mean, it's pretty strong regardless, but this certainly makes it, I guess, more relevant or more explicit in terms of its connection to our own, you know, society.
Yeah. Dave continues, this pattern is all too familiar, and it is not without irony that many of the Imperials sound British or from that part of the world. The tragedy of many worlds, and ultimately we can assume Eldani, that fell under the Empire's sway, is that they suffered the same fate we see in Chinua Achebe's seminal work, All Things Fall Apart. Side note, also an excellent Roots album. In this novel, Achebe describes how the arrival of British missionaries and culture supplanted the traditional social dynamics and mores of the main character's own native tribe, with their native religion usurped by Christianity, and only Christians gaining preferred access to goods that were deemed better than the native utensils that once supported a vibrant culture. Another facet of the Eldani arc that is consistent with colonialism is the sense of superiority of the occupier. We see the Imperials dismiss the Eldani rituals as backwards, hinting at an absence of civilization. This arrogance is epitomized by the scoff at the apparent stench of the animal hides the two sides are to exchange. On the other hand, the Eldani ritual belays a deep connection with the planet, with nature, and a connection that is to be cherished. The elder admonishes the Imperials, telling them the planet has a memory. Once again, This brought to mind the diametrically opposed worldviews of European occupiers and the first peoples of the Americas and civilizations in Africa. Their worlds were living entities with the life of the planet sustaining their life in a symbiotic relationship. In the eyes of the European occupiers and the Empire in Star Wars, and to a certain extent, one could argue the Old Republic, each land slash planet is a reservoir of resources to be exploited and used. There is no real give and take. And before I continue with Dave's writing here, I think something that this brings to mind, explored in another work that I think Dave would also appreciate me bringing up here, is the case of Shinra in Final Fantasy VII. All right, and now I'll continue. Sadly, this colonial legacy laid the foundation for the current capitalist order upon which the world operates today. And it is only now, with the real issues of climate change, that we are trying to shirk this exploitative bent and pursue sustainable development goals. This is the message that Andor's the series seems to be beating into my historian mind. And I think that it is clearly one of the underlying messages the creators want to convey. It is incredibly unsettling, but also important, I feel. In addition, the fact that this series began airing after the death of Queen Elizabeth, with her passing sparking debate in Commonwealth nations and former colonies as to the British Empire's legacy, further enhances the relevance of these themes in the episode. Any thoughts on that paragraph, John?
No. I mean, certainly the condescension of the, you know, the Imperials towards the native people, I think, is one of the most damning, you know, elements of that episode, of the Imperials in that episode. You know, the episode goes out of its way to make clear, you know, how little respect and understanding they do have an understanding of the natives, but it's in a very sort of disrespectful and manipulative way. So it's like, you know, the smug kind of statement that, yeah, you know, these native people, we can just string them along and manipulate them and give them almost nothing and you know, make them addicted to it, and then, you know, we'll remain in control. I mean, I think that's, you know, Dave points out how that is something Imperial powers have done historically. And then I think also, like, even if you look at, you know, just within like American society and the way certain groups, you know, namely the poor, inner city poor, in America are, you know, looked down upon in the same way. And I think in a lot of ways, like, intentionally, you know, kept dependent on like cheap food, you know, cheap drugs, like that kind of thing. Like, I feel like there is, from a certain element of, upper, I don't know, like, the power elite that you know, are quite happy to, you know, keep people powerless, dependent, and that sort of thing in a similar sort of way. So yeah, certainly see all of that there as well.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I mean, I think like we can think back to like the Reagan era was notorious for, you know, that administration and the CIA just pushing cheap drugs into those communities. And yeah, I think those and that's, you know, we still see the effects of that today. And, you know, even going back to like the, you know, the moves to suburbs, in like the 50s and 60s and, you know, the right now, like in Denver, we're seeing, you know, the gentrification of, you know, urban areas and people being like pushed out to, you know, cheaper housing. And, I mean, this is all stuff like on a societal level that is, still very relevant today. And I think, like that stuff all like that Dave was talking about there was like all stuff that like I certainly picked up on when I was watching. But I think, the way he brings up some of the environmental themes, was not something that was necessarily top of mind for me, when I was watching that. So rewatching this series is going to be so interesting, you know, because for one, we're like, you know, we're constantly learning more and seeing like characters' arcs grow and change throughout the episodes. But also like some of this discussion around it, I think is going to like really reframe how we view some of these episodes, later, which is the sign of good art. All right, now I'm going to continue. Dave's now, he's got a couple more paragraphs here. The last thing I will close on is political ideology and propaganda. In watching Andor, I have gone back to the amazing Star Wars propaganda. I was calling it propaganda.
You want to say propagandy.
Propagandy. by Pablo Hidalgo, looking at the propaganda in that, in particular, imperial propaganda, and juxtaposing that with real life propaganda seen in Japan in World War II. It is frighteningly scary how much the fictional propaganda in that Star Wars book mirrors what was in circulation in real life in Japan. Also in the West as well, I will add. But the art styles, the over-the-top messaging that tries, that encourages everyone to sacrifice their individuality for the greater cause while subtly dissuading open criticism, it's all there. And going forward with the Andor series, I hope we can catch more glimpses of this propaganda in the background on Coruscant and other imperial ruled worlds. And then Dave goes on to talk about how that on a totally different note, Hayden Christensen, Ian McDiarmid, and Anthony Daniels are coming to Tokyo Comic Con at the end of November. So he's going to be going to that and is debating a meet and greet with Ian McDiarmid, knowing that he's getting up there in age and probably may not be always traveling to places like Japan in the future. So, and he's looking forward to meeting up with some Japanese Star Wars fans, which is cool. And he closes with a very nice message to us saying, "All the best, guys. Your discourse of Andor has been most welcome over this past month and a half. So thank you, Dave.
Yes. Thank you, Dave. And Dave's discourse, here, and just like, historical insights and, I don't know, cultural, societal insights, political insights. Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely, kind of enriching, my understanding of the relationship between the Empire and Andor and, some of these communities. So, always insightful, always compelling, and we appreciate you taking the time, Dave, to put this together and, making it possible for us to include this in the show. So all the best to you as well, Dave.
Everywhere there is life, but you must face death. Honor it. Do not fear it. Jedi. Ahsoka is Jedi.
The best way I can protect you is to teach you how to protect yourself.
Master Dooku.
I want to bring peace and order to the galaxy.
Master, stop!
It is the only way you will truly have victory, my Padawan.
Again. Again.
Dooku, stand down.
Been warning them about the coming darkness. Let's hope all that training pays off.
And who might you be?
All right. We are into the second portion of the show here, Ryan, where we're going to attempt to talk about Tales of the Jedi and this Hollywood Reporter story. So let's lead with Tales of the Jedi. And we're moving to Tales of the Jedi, but there was one more thing I wanted to say about Andor episode 8, and I feel like it really connects to like part of Dave's message there too. My highlight from episode 8 is seeing Cassian in one of those tunnels. And him noticing that one of the prisoners is like making like gestures and signs to a prisoner in another tunnel.
Oh, yeah.
And it just it's like really that theme of like communities coming together to rebel in any way possible. I don't know how, you know, best way to describe that, but it's totally the same thing as on Ferrix, you know, when they hit the little chimes and, you know, alert each other. Like they have this like kind of way of communicating as a rebellion, you know, maybe not like an organized rebellion with a capital R, but like people will rebel, right? They will rebel. So I thought that was really brilliant. And also I got to say too, I don't know if this is intentional, but I feel like it is. Those tunnels look just like tunnels that we see in Attack of the Clones on Kamino. And this is like a planet that's like in the ocean, or not a planet, but like a prison or whatever that's like in the ocean where people are being dehumanized. And I feel like there is in the design there probably an intentional connection between those ideas, you know, the way the clones, you know, dehumanized by the Republic and these prisoners dehumanized here by the Empire. So on to Tales of the Jedi. Let's talk about Tales of the Jedi. Ryan, I thought Tales of the Jedi was great. I have a strong preference for the Dooku episodes more so than the Ahsoka episodes. Do you share that?
Yeah, I would say like I think the Ahsoka episodes are, you know, a great treat for like hardcore Clone Wars, hardcore Ahsoka fans. There is some gap filling in that happens there. I would say those episodes kind of expect you to be a super hardcore fan of Clone Wars, like the early seasons, the most recent season. So that, because I think to get the full impact, you have to know like, oh, this happens right before this thing happens. And I think like it's cool. I don't think that's my favorite style of storytelling in the world, to that approach. But you know, I think for like super fans, I think those episodes are probably pretty cool. But for me, yes, the highlight was the Dooku trilogy here, specifically the third episode in that trilogy of Dooku episodes, which was you know, everything you ever wanted to know that was unexplained in Attack of the Clones but were afraid to ask. It is right there.
Yeah, no, it was really great. I mean, I also think the Ahsoka episodes are good, you know, but there's just something for me, like, I guess we've seen a lot of Ahsoka in this animated format, obviously. Mm-hmm. Like, that's kind of like her primary, you know, sort of like entrance point. And the most time we've spent with her in Star Wars is in this kind of Clone Wars, you know, sort of style. And this is very similar to the Clone Wars in terms of like the aesthetic and the style and that sort of thing. But then, you know, and just to see a young Qui-Gon, we haven't gotten much of that, right? And to see a younger Dooku, to see a Dooku like as a Jedi, I'm not totally as caught up on stuff as I should be, I guess, because I haven't read Dooku or listened to Dooku Jedi Lost or whatever that's mm-hmm. called. I think that's what it's called. So, you know, I know there's more young Dooku or younger Dooku out there than I'm familiar with or have, you know, consumed. But yeah, to me, just seeing like a young Qui-Gon Jinn, Dooku and Qui-Gon together as a master and Padawan, mm-hmm. you know, that sort of thing was really compelling to see, I suppose, in all three of the episodes, some level of darkness in Dooku, but you know, to sort of still see him operating as a Jedi, and for these stories to really kind of continue the what the prequel started as far as demonstrating how the Jedi were, I guess I would say, like, always well-intentioned, but really losing their way during this prequel era, because, you know, like Yaddle even tells Dooku, you know, you were right about so many things. And man, I love too, like the moment where Dooku says, like, oh yeah, like what was it, like creativity, like a creative mind or something like that, or like an imagination, mm-hmm. I think that's what it was. Mm-hmm. You know, he tells Yaddle, like, oh yeah, that's something that's not appreciated. And the line kind of parallels the line where Yoda tells Obi-Wan, oh, a quality less and less common, or more and more common in Jedi and Attack of the Clones. I think Dooku here mm-hmm. says that's something less and less appreciated in the Jedi order or something like that. I think it was meant to parallel that line. Just like, I guess, you know, and Chris, California Chris, who we talked about earlier, he always says like Qui-Gon's the ultimate Jedi. And in a lot of ways, I feel like Qui-Gon is like the ultimate Jedi of the prequel era, you know, because he does question the mistakes of the Jedi Order and, you know, just in a way that's maybe less likely to lead him down a dark path than Dooku. But it was just mm-hmm. really interesting just to see Dooku, you know, being rightfully critical of the Jedi, but, you know, reacting with a darkness that is obviously, you know, going to lead him down a path we don't want to see him go down.
Yeah. And I think, like, for me, the, like, you texted me and was like, and well, you texted our group chat on the day these came out, and you're like, holy crap, like the third Dooku episode goes so hard. And I was like, really? I haven't watched it yet. And at that point I had just watched the first two. And I was like, yeah, these are pretty good. Like, this is kind of exactly what I expected these episodes would be, you know, like some, you know, two Jedi, a master and apprentice on like various missions, and, you know, we get to kind of see, you know, the formation of Qui-Gon's approach to everything, and then we get to kind of see the descent of Dooku, and, you know, some of like the red flags, which is, you know, that's a Star Wars story we've gotten quite a bit in the past, and In like those episodes, I was like, yeah, okay, that's, you know, pretty much what I expected. It's cool. I watched some and I was like, yeah, I'll probably check the rest out later and stuff. And then like, you were like, you got to watch this third episode. And so I was like, okay. So something shifts here. And so, yeah, I think like, to me, that third Dooku episode is just, I think, maybe like justifies the whole thing, the whole project, because like it's like, it's kind of one of those things where like I mentioned, like I don't love when Star Wars just takes to like filling in gaps, like, hey, this is what happened 10 minutes before this thing that, you know, I feel like we can, you know, give each story like some room to breathe and we don't have to know every detail. But I think in this case, like, it was kind of one of those things that just needed to happen eventually. And I think this was probably the right medium for us to, you know, for some of these questions of like, who was Sifo Dyas? Who, you know, whatever happened to Yaddle? Those kind of things. I think this was.
I will say that's not a question I was asking, but I guess other people had been. I wasn't asking that myself, but
I remember people were asking. When
there's an in-universe answer and there's an out-of-universe answer, but I guess I'll be classy and just not state what the out-of-universe answer is. But that's fine.
No, I think people were like asking that when in like Mandalorian season one, episode one, after the reveal of Grogu, when like it's like, okay, is this really the only one of this race? Because people are like, obviously Yoda's dead, but where's Yaddle? I think when you're watching Star Wars, anytime Yaddle is not on the screen, the audience should be asking, where's Yaddle?
All right. Yeah. I mean, I will say I thought Yaddle was great in these episodes. And oh, so totally. Was fun. Watching The Phantom Menace in 1999, it was like, there's a girl Yoda on screen. The girl Yoda doesn't have any meaningful role or anything, but it's just like, it just too, you talk about like seeing Andy Serkis taking you out of the experience of watching the show, like watching The Phantom Menace in 1999, like, hey, there's girl Yoda just sitting back there. Like Yoda was this like mystical, mysterious kind of like, what is a, you know what I mean? Like we know nothing about him. And they're like, ah, we'll just toss one in the background. Like, oh, I guess there's more Yodas. Like that was not the way to do it. Grogu, on the other hand, oh my gosh, so much mystique, so much, you know, there's something, it was so compelling. So I feel like, you know, to me, look, I mean, do I think it's fun now, like a Yaddle as a concept or whatever? Sure. But I don't think it was a particularly strong creative decision to be like, let's have another Yoda. We won't do anything with her, but also her name will be real dumb and sound just like Yoda. You know what I mean? Like that was not a particularly strong creative choice in 1999.
Yes. And so I think like on a more serious note, I think this also was like a, like it actually gave Yaddle a character arc and a purpose. And we in a very short amount of time, we learned a lot about that character and their philosophies and their, you know, sense of justice and right and wrong. And they became more fully fleshed out as a character rather than just like a meme, basically.
Sure. So yeah, sure.
I think like, I think that was like a noble endeavor. And I think like you're telling this, this Dooku story, and there's plenty of Jedi that you could have used there. I think Yaddle was an inspired choice here.
Yeah, I think maybe so. Although I will say, like, I love this episode, by the way. I loved it. I've watched it twice. I think it's really, really good. I love this episode. So these are just light criticisms, you know, no big deal. But I will say there were a few moments watching it for the second time where I was like, this is leaning a little heavily, like, in terms of the music and the visual presentation. It's leaning a little heavily into sort of repeating stuff from Attack of the Clones or from, okay, so it's instead of Yoda and Dooku fighting at the end of Attack of the Clones, now it's Yaddle and Dooku. You know what I mean? Like, that's maybe a little shaky, but on the other hand, I think it does make sense. Like, it should be, like, I would not want it to be, like, just a Jedi Dan. You know what I mean? Like, we talked about just, like, some random Jedi dude in a robe or whatever that I've never heard of before. Mm-hmm. And then, like, I think that would have been kind of distracting too. I mean, that could have worked, I guess, but, like, I think it's good that it's a Jedi that we know existed already, but not one that there's much storytelling around, so that, like, you don't have to worry about, okay, well, I mean, obviously Yaddle's going to die in this scene, in this episode. So, like, they can't show up in any other prequels, you know, like, Yaddle's kind of the perfect Jedi in that scenario. Cause, like, we know she exists, but we also never see her again. So it totally works, like, in terms of it being someone you're familiar with, but also it's okay to kill him off in that moment.
Yeah. And I think, like, and I'm using this term lovingly, because I would say I loved this episode, in particular, the one we're discussing, but this entire series of shorts is fan service. Like, it's, I don't feel like these were necessary stories in any way. Like, I didn't need to see Ahsoka as a baby. Like, I mean, some people were like, I cannot move on with Star Wars until I cannot process any stories until I see, I can't believe we're getting a live action show and we've never even seen Ahsoka as a baby. You know, that may be a deal breaker for some people. I think, like, all of these episodes are ultimately, I don't want to say, like, unnecessary. Like, I don't mean this in, like, a condescending or a mean way or anything. Because I did enjoy them, but they're just, they are, like, a lot of it is, like, getting the viewer to be like, hey, I know this, kind of thing, especially, like, I think with the, you know, Ahsoka stories, you know, where they, like, come in right at the moment where you're like, oh, that's that scene from the other thing. And I think what you were just saying with the parallels to the Dooku Yoda fight in episode 2, like, it looks exactly like that. And, you know, with Yaddle jumping and spinning around and stuff. And I think there is just, I mean, just kind of like this pure, well-intentioned fan service there.
Yeah, I agree. But also, I think, you know, in defense of these, I think that the short is, like, the right medium. And you said this, you know, you said that earlier, but I think the short is the right medium to tell a story like this. And I think it's also, it demonstrates that the creators, you know, I guess primarily Dave Filoni, but the rest of the creative team understood that as well, right? You know, I think, like, hey, these are smaller stories. They, I also, like, hate when people talk about, like, stories being necessary or not, or an episode or a show being like, I didn't. In fact, I was arguing with a friend of ours last night. I don't need it. I don't need any more stories set in this time period. Like, I don't want to watch any Star Wars unless it's 1,000 years before or after the Skywalker saga, because otherwise it's going to be full of cameos. Blah, 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 blah. Mm. Like, just whatever. But anyway, like, I don't need it. It's not necessary. Like, well, nothing is. Okay. Like, you know, I mean, and it's okay if Dave Filoni wants to make some, you know, short stories in an animated form, and of this high a quality, like, go for it. Like, it's okay. It doesn't have to be, there doesn't have to be some higher purpose or need for it, you know? So, like, it's like, yeah, I agree that, like, I didn't need to see Ahsoka as a baby. That's also my very much my least favorite of the episodes, but you know, it's fine. But that's the one we saw in Anaheim. And it was like, okay, well, this is cool. But like, really, I don't really think I learned anything besides like back of the toy, like factoids, you know, information about Ahsoka from that episode. Like, what did I learn? Like, and it's okay. Like, again, that's what I'm saying. Like, I don't, it's not like you have to justify its existence or it has to like, you know, really enrich things or whatever. It can just be like an enjoyable 15-minute short film, and that's what it is. But you know, I would say like there's a little more going on in the second and third Ahsoka stories than that first one. That first one was really just like, wouldn't it be cool to see like Ahsoka as a baby? Like, I guess I know that like the people in her life, you know, recognized that she had a connection to the Force based on that, but okay, you know, I don't know. It's just I don't know. I'm not sure what the big takeaway there was. Like, it could have been like if we got to see like how gut-wrenching it was for her parents to send her off to the Jedi Order, like, okay, maybe that would be like, that would be pretty relevant. Like, that's a story that could be I think more, I hate the word, I don't want to say necessary, but like, I would definitely see where, yeah, like, I know why they wanted to tell that story. But as it is, like, Ahsoka almost gets eaten by a tiger, but then she doesn't. It's like, I don't know. I mean, I guess her connection to other beings is what we're learning about there, but I pretty much already knew that that was there, you know? So,
yeah, I don't think that's going to, like, if I ever go back and like watch, rewatch the Clone Wars or something down the road, I don't think like these episodes are going to completely like reframe the, you know, my understanding of that show or anything. But
Dooku and the Qui-Gon ones, the Dooku ones, really do kind of explore some of the big thematic ideas of like the Star Wars saga, you know? And it's not like ground that's never been covered before, for sure. It's a similar kind of ideas, but, like I was saying before, you know, I think like seeing the reasons Dooku was kind of deceived or pushed into, you know, and turning to the dark side is definitely worth, you know, worth spending some time with. And I thought the execution of that story was really strong as well, super well done. And, yeah, so I love those ones. And I think even the other two, like you said, you know, it's not like we haven't seen characters kind of being pushed towards the dark side before. It's nothing new, but I think it was really well done. And I enjoyed that. And also like the Sifo-Dyas stuff and, you know, just kind of getting a little more concrete information about that. That felt huge, you know?
Yeah.
That felt huge. The moment where Dooku, you know, even just, I guess he'd already basically turned to the dark side at that point, but, you know, sort of in some of his final moments as a Jedi, you know, standing there looking at the tree that he used to take young Qui-Gon Jinn to, to look at, like, man, beautiful stuff there. So, I really liked, the Dooku ones and, even the Ahsoka, the final one, I think was a pretty exciting and pretty fun, episode. Again, like I've seen it in Jedi Fallen Order and lots of other Star Wars stories. Like, you're a Jedi, it's dangerous to be, you know, identified or whatever. And that sort of thing. But also, you know, it was like, what is going to get Ahsoka back into the rebellion? What's going to get her back into, you know, kind of wanting to act again. And so I think it answers that question. Now I will say, and I read the book Ahsoka a long time ago, but I don't really remember much of what happens in it, but
yeah,
I'm seeing a lot of criticism or frustration from some fans who sort of, I think the argument is that that book kind of already told that story of how and why she kind of goes back to sort of getting involved in this galactic conflict again, and that this episode of Tales of the Jedi sort of contradicts, or, yeah, I've seen people use like words like decanonize or whatever. I doubt that's really,
but I haven't like really engaged in that or like thought about it, because like,
yeah,
it doesn't super matter to me. But yeah, I saw people like saying that, and then I saw people being like, no, this is why it doesn't, because X, Y, and Z at like this time. And there may be a consensus on it now, or people may still be arguing about it. I don't know. But
yeah,
either way, is what it is. Yeah.
It is what it is. And I've always been one of those people who, and I don't know if this is a popular opinion or a valid one or not, but I've always been one of those people who kind of looks at, you know, books and comics and video games and it's all canon. Yes. Like that's the decree from Lucasfilm. And I think we want it to be connected and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But I've always been one to say, like, to sort of be a little more relaxed about that kind of thing. Like, okay, well, you know, if something in a novel or something in a comic doesn't exactly line up with a movie or a show, especially when they're made years and years apart from one another, mm-hmm. I'm a little more like, it just, you know, my personal preference or whatever. I'm just kind of like, okay, well, there's real life concerns and, you know, maybe it's from a different point of view or just, you know, I don't know. I can enjoy a video game, even if the story of the video game maybe doesn't totally line up with a movie or a TV show. And I think if I read a book, you know, in 2022 and then in 2027, a TV show or a movie or a game or something kind of has a slightly different take on something, I'm not, I can't barely remember what happens in Ahsoka. So that's a pretty good, you know, evidence as to why this kind of stuff doesn't worry me too much. But I definitely do understand, like, if people are frustrated like that, it feels like a lack of respect to E.K. Johnston or a lack of respect mm-hmm. to like that book and to fans. And that, I mean, I do get that too. So, I don't know.
It's just an argument where I don't really have a horse in the race. I would agree in particular.
Yeah.
I mean, again, like Star Wars is like the in-universe explanation of Star Wars. It was a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away, and these are stories told by unreliable narrators. So
yeah, and on the subject too of like some of these being more necessary or more kind of important or whatever than others, you know, I think right now we're watching this show Andor, in which, you know, some people complain that certain episodes not enough happens or they're not exciting enough or whatever. And it's like, well, yeah, but, you know, obviously those things are building towards other things. And I think there's some of that going on with Tales of the Jedi. And then also, like, you know, if every episode was trying to be like this, like, here's the answer to Sifo-Dyas, you know what I mean? Or like, you're going to see Yaddle and get decapitated. Like, it, you know, if every episode tried to have like some major thing like that, then, you know, none of them are going to feel as special as, like, you know, I feel like that Dooku one does feel so special because there's six episodes of Tales of the Jedi, but only one of them is really trying to like tackle a huge kind of moment in Star Wars like that, you know, mm-hmm. and the other ones are smaller moments. And I think that makes the moment with, you know, that fourth Dooku episode that much more, you know, impactful.
Yeah. Yeah.
Would you be happy to hear of more Tales of the Jedi in the pipeline, Ryan? Would you be looking forward to more short Tales of the Jedi episodes?
I don't think it's something I really need. Honestly, like, I think these were fine, and if there were more, like, if they seem compelling, I would watch them. But it's not something I'm like chomping at the bit for. I'm just being like totally honest.
I devil's advocate, I would be pretty excited, I think, to know that more were on the way, but also, just because it is such a low stakes kind of thing with them being these short animated episodes, I just feel like that's like, it's like, I don't know, I'm not going to like anticipate them wildly for years until they come out or anything like that. I don't want to say I'd forgotten about these, but they weren't like super on my radar. But then, like, you know, on Wednesday when I sat down and watched them, I was like, oh, this is really fun. And, you know, if I didn't love some of the episodes, it was no big deal. And then when I did, like, was way more impacted by that one Dooku episode than I expected, then that was really cool too. So, I hope for more, but it's not like I'm going to be dying for more of them necessarily, but I think the short format is a great way to tackle some stories that we might not otherwise see on screen. Ryan, I'm thinking we should wait until next week to tackle the Hollywood Reporter story. What do you think?
Okay, we'll wait until we get, maybe we'll get some more information.
That's exactly what I was going to say. I feel like the story is going to be exactly the same next week, and like whatever sort of reaction we have to it or predictions we have.
I have a lot to say about this, so
I don't want to give it short.
Like way over time, so
exactly. Let's wait. All right, cool. So next week we'll come back. We'll talk about Andor episode 9, and we'll talk about this. This bombshell story from the Hollywood Reporter about Damon Lindelof's new Star Wars movie. So until then, thank you very much for listening. If you want to find the other shows we've put out and other things we've written and posted, all of that is over at blockaderunnerpodcast.com. Thanks again for the message from Dave Hackerson, our friend Dave in Japan. If you want to message the show or share your thoughts on Star Wars with us, you can email the show, blockaderunnerpodcast@gmail.com, or you can follow the show on Twitter at blockaderun and message us there as well. And Ryan, you are on Twitter at?
Vaya Malay, V-A-Y-A-M-A-L-A-Y. And I also want to throw out Dave's Twitter handle. It's at N-O-R-S-K-A-K-I. R-U-N-O.
Good. So until next time, thanks for listening, and we will be back soon with another episode of the Blockade Runner podcast.
We are all the Republic.